On today's edition of Two-Way Street, we're going to go underground. We'll explore cool, dark, subterranean regions where thousands of species, from humans to reptiles to insects, have sought shelter and safety, in some cases for hundreds of millions of years. Here in Georgia, as we go through our daily lives, underfoot, underground, there's an ecosystem teeming with life. And the creatures that burrow in the longleaf pine forests of southwest Georgia or along the seacoast not only are securing refuge for themselves, they're providing human life with benefits we may not even know. We're going to explore this world with Anthony Martin. He's a professor of paleontology and geology at Emory University. He's just published a new book, The Evolution Underground: Burrows, Bunkers, and the Marvelous Subterranean World Beneath Our Feet. By the way, Martin is also an ichnologist, a scientist who studies the traces left by animals, which helps explain his interest in burrowing.
Sometimes I jokingly refer to myself as an ichno-evangelist, in that I really want to convert everybody to the Church of Ichnology. And the Church of Ichnology, I teach my students, has a holy trinity to it: substrate, anatomy, and behavior. Amen, Brother Bill. So with that, I want people to think about how substrate is what preserves a trace. Anatomy is what an animal uses to make a trace, such as a foot or a hand or teeth. Then there's the behavior behind it. So implicit in that is where an animal is alive when it makes a trace. And for me as an ichnologist, this is incredibly exciting to find, say, a dinosaur footprint or a trilobite burrow. These are vestiges of ancient behavior of where a living animal interacted with its environment millions of years ago.
We're going to talk about the various things that you cite in your book that'll help people understand a little better just what you described. But one of the bonuses for me in reading your book was that a good deal of it is set right here in Georgia on the Georgia seacoast, St. Catherine's Island. And you describe St. Catherine's Island in such a rich and exciting way, I think. And one of the points you make is that when you ask people to describe a place that is rich in biodiversity, their thoughts immediately go to places like, what, the Great Barrier Reef?
The Great Barrier Reef, the Amazon Basin, Southern Africa, and I say Georgia.
Yeah, and you say, and you talk very specifically about that diversity as it plays out on St. Catherine's Island, although I assume that up and down that Georgia seacoast, we'd find similar environments.
Right. So what's unique about Georgia, I think, is we have mountains, we have sea, and then we have this very broad coastal plain. And this coastal plain has this long ecological history, too, that predates even Native Americans coming into the area, and then, of course, the Europeans modifying those environments very much so. In that coastal plain, we also are blessed enough to have gopher tortoises, and I talk about them in the book as these big biodiversity boosters we have here in Georgia. Then the coast is unique. We have one-third of all of the salt marshes in the eastern U.S. right here in Georgia, and then all of the biodiversity.
What is a salt marsh?
A salt marsh, thank you for asking that. A salt marsh is a wetland environment. It's immersed by the sea with daily tides. But it is often, the salt marshes on the Georgia coast, it's often dominated by one species of plant, Spartina alterniflora, otherwise known as smooth cordgrass, but even the locals call it Spartina. This plant is so well adapted to those marshes that they basically are the marsh. Then there are animals that also burrow beneath the Spartina and make the marsh what it is. But these are basically, on our coast, I guess you would say nurseries for a lot of animals that live along and in the waters of the coast.
When I make the drive out the long two-lane road out to, say, Jekyll Island, I'm surrounded by what appears to be marshes. There's tall grass growing there. Are those salt marshes typically?
Those are salt marshes.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, gorgeous marshes that go off into the horizon.
Where will we find varieties, like 1,000 varieties of plants in Georgia, leading to thousands of varieties of insects? Where do we find that?
You would find that kind of biodiversity in the longleaf pine forests and the wiregrass communities that are in southwest Georgia and some other parts of South Georgia. Southwest Georgia has also, not coincidentally, gopher tortoises. And the gopher tortoises are actually the ecosystem engineers that make this happen. So when a building's made in here in downtown Atlanta, for instance, we think about the engineers, we think about the construction workers all working together to make that building happen. You might also think about gopher tortoises as making a lot of that happen through their long, deep burrows, their mixing of soils, bringing up seeds from below for these plants, as well as adaptations by the animals that live in the burrows. They are the landlords of the sand hills. They have as many as 300 to 400 species of animals living in the burrows with them.
You say that there few animals can match them for sheer burrowing prowess. Now, these are not large tortoises, right? These
They're about the size of a dinner plate.
Small,
yeah.
Size of a dinner plate.
Mm-hmm.
How do they dig?
They have these very good, strong, robust digging claws. They have really strong shoulders. And what they do is they will dig 1, 2, 3, 4 with the right side, 1, 2, 3, 4 with the left side. And as they're pushing back the dirt, as they're moving down into the soil, they're also using their rear feet to push it out too. But it's mostly their front feet and their arms that are doing the work. Now, as they start going into the ground, though, they have this shell. And this shell helps to compact the soil around them. This is how they have such strong, robust walls to their burrows, because you think, well, how did they do that? Well, it's through their shell. It's not like they padded it with their hands on the way down.
I think you say that the burrow actually takes on the shape that the shell appears, almost like a half moon kind of shape.
That's correct. Yeah, it's really neat to look at these in cross-section because they have that half moon shape. And you can imagine then that's the length of the tortoise. So the minimum length of the tortoise that it can go into that burrow and then use it as its own. Now, what's very interesting, I think, about them is that they don't dig just one burrow and leave it at that. They have as many as 2-3 dozen burrows that each individual might dig, and they might go from one to the other. So they may have these active social lives that we don't know about unless we put out a camera and watch them. I never assume one burrow has just one tortoise, that there's a lot going on there.
And they become the home, as you've just said, for hundreds of other species of animals.
That's right. So the indigo snake, which is the longest snake we have in Georgia, for instance, really depends on those burrows. And it uses those burrows as a place to stay safe, and that's a theme throughout the book, is that burrows keep us safe. Rattlesnakes will also use these as homes. Mice will use them, and then a whole range of insects, including insects that are specialized in cleaning up the waste of the gopher tortoises. So they have their own private sanitation system down there that's perfectly evolved for them.
Let me back up, if I may, and ask probably the most basic question. Why do animals burrow? And for how long have they been burrowing?
Animals have been burrowing minimally about 550 million years. It may have started as a result of looking for more food in the seafloor. But I also talk about in the book how it also is a way to play hide and seek for keeps. That if you have predators that are regarding you as a meal, that's a good way to hide, is to dig below ground and become invisible. What also happened, though, was predators started using these burrows as places for ambush predation. That today we have here in Georgia, for instance, wolf spiders that will make a burrow, vertical burrow, goes down into the soil, and they will jump out and get any prey that's there. Antlions do the same thing today, too. But if you go to the deep sea, you have these really cool worms called bobbit worms that leap up and actually will eat fish. This sort of ambush predation probably started soon after burrowing started. Then burrowing later became a great way to avoid natural disasters. So we could think about storms, for instance, fires, volcanic eruptions, and even meteorite impacts I talk about in the book, that might have been a way for animals to survive one of the worst hits the Earth ever took.
So I'm fascinated by your descriptions of human burrowing. Tell us the story about going to Cappadocia. You went there with your wife. What is Cappadocia, and why was it so interesting to you?
Well, we knew
it's in Turkey, we should say.
Right. It's in central Turkey, on a plateau in central Turkey. It takes a long time to get there by bus. So my wife and I, we were first in Istanbul, visiting Istanbul, which is one of the best cities in the world, an incredible place. We took an overnight bus to get to Cappadocia. It's not easy to get to. And then once we got there, we saw the reason why we were there, and it was the fantastic landscape there. There are these erosional remnants of volcanic sandstone there called hoodoos, these pillars, and all of these natural caves that had formed from erosion of that soft sandstone. But thousands of years ago, maybe starting with the Hittites, as long ago as 5,000 years ago, people realized they could burrow into the ground there. What that did was it kept them cool during the hot summers there, and it kept them warm during the cool winters. They also then later were able to adapt these homes to defense. And this is a very interesting aspect of that human history there, is that once the Roman Empire started taking over that area, early Christians were able to use these places as refuges, and they developed these huge underground cities, these vast networks of anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 people that could have lived down there at a time. Later then, they used it again for defense against the Ottoman Empire. And now these are tourist attractions, but they're still discovering more of these underground cities in that area. Yeah, so one of the places we went to there is Derinkuyu. That's one of the more famous underground cities there in that part of Cappadocia. And there's several that tourists can visit. So my wife and I signed up for a tour and went underground. And that's when it gave me the kernel of an idea about how humans also have these propensities for seeking safety underground. And there's even a whole range of fiction, a genre of fiction called subterranean fiction that dates back to Dante's Inferno all the way up to The Hunger Games, where we think about safety and we think underground. So that thought stuck with me, and later on when I was considering writing this book, I thought about that as that had to be one of the chapters about how we have this deep-seated, perhaps intrinsic connection to that as a place of refuge.
And at what time frame are we talking about when the area of Cappadocia, these underground cities were popping up? What are we talking about time frame?
Looking back, about 5,000 years maybe, and that would have been with the Hittites or some of the people associated with them in that area, and then continuing until, I think, through the Ottoman Empire.
You would call that the ancient past, I think. But you bring us much more up to date. You talk about the United States government looking at underground shelters to protect against nuclear attacks.
That's right. And that's something where the Department of Defense has still used this as a strategy in its portfolio of defenses against attack. And we still have operational facilities, U.S. government facilities, that are kept purposefully underground. But a lot of the initial work on these underground facilities started with the Cold War. So starting in the late 1950s, once we had the Cold War between the United States and the former Soviet Union, the U.S. government put a lot of money and resources into building some of these facilities, one of which is Site R, Raven Mountain Complex, that's in southern Pennsylvania, and there were several others that were built with the purpose of continuing government and continuing military support in the event of a nuclear attack.
The Pennsylvania facility dug some 650 feet below the surface, you tell us. It included office buildings, an infirmary, water treatment plants and reservoirs. You tell us it even has a barber shop.
That's, yeah, that's what I read in, unfortunately, what were secondary sources. I have not been there myself.
Okay.
I doubt I'll ever be there. So I'm as a skeptical scientist, I report what I've read. And I say, yeah, isn't that fascinating to think about how there would have been such complete facilities for long-term living for people underground there. So going back to that Cappadocian heritage, I guess you would say.
So if we can continue with the human underground story, you also talk about underground cities that were built for protection from the elements. There's a city in Australia, for instance. Tell us about it.
Yeah, there's the city of Coober Pedy, which I've been to Australia a bunch of times, but I haven't been to that city, and it's on my checklist, places to visit. It just sounds fascinating. What happened was opal mining started there in, I think it was the 1920s. And the opal miners are digging out this soft sandstone, looking for beautiful gem quality opal. Over generations, they've been doing this. Well, what they discovered was living on the surface was really awful because the summers there get up to 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Just brutal summers there. They realized that when they were underground, they were just fine. So they realized that they could adapt a lot of these abandoned mines into homes. And you can look at some YouTube videos of some of these homes where they do a tour of homes, but they're all underground. And they're just spectacular, some of these places. And it makes sense that they would use those sort of places as ways to keep out of the sun and keep down your energy bills, and it's good, nice living down there. They even have underground pubs there.
Well, and you tell us that it's actually become a tourism destination, that there is a hotel there, and as you point out, pub, restaurants. So people are going to visit and see what it's like to have this underground living style.
Yeah, people go there. They're attracted to the opal and the opal mining and a lot of jewelry that's associated with that. But also this fascinating dimension to having an underground city where there are all of these people who are living below ground there and all of these below ground facilities there for tourists.
So since some species used burrowing as an escape from prey, you draw a parallel to human burrowing as an escape from predation, and kind of chilling examples. Tell me about, for instance, Vilnius, Poland.
Oh, yes. That was just a recent discovery in which some archaeologists were looking at Vilnius in Lithuania, where there was a killing ground, and it was the Nazis had a concentration camp, and they were killing all of the Jews who they had imprisoned there. There was a pit they had outside of the facility where they forced some of the prisoners to dig graves for all of the bodies, to dispose of the bodies. Well, what these prisoners did was they secretly dug an escape tunnel on the wall of the pit. And enough of them escaped. Most of them were captured and killed, unfortunately. But enough of them escaped that they were able to get to the Allies to tell them what was there and tell their story of how they escaped. Oh, it's just it's really emotional to read about this and understand that's what they did. Archaeologists, I think it was just last year, were able to use ground-penetrating radar and other scientific techniques to be able to detect the tunnel. So they verified the story of the prisoners, that this is how they got out of there. And from what I understand, that's going to be encapsulated in a NOVA special coming up sometime this year.
Before we leave humans, and I do want to move on to a couple of you have a great chapter in here called Rulers of the Underworld, and I really want to talk a little bit about a couple of examples of those. But this is pure speculation at this point. It's not something you discuss in any detail in the book. But we all know the planet is heating up. And we know temperatures are likely to continue to increase. We also know that energy resources are going to be more and more limited. I'm wondering if you envision a future in which returning to underground living or working environments becomes a necessity because we have to escape from the environment around us that we've lost some control over.
I do see that future happening, and I do see that as a part of our coping as a species with climate change, is that here in Georgia, we've experienced one of the mildest winters in memory, and we've also experienced globally, I think, the three hottest recorded years in history, in recorded history. So with this climate change, and speaking as an environmental scientist, we acknowledge that this is happening, and what are we going to do? How are we going to cope with that? And underground is going to be part of that solution. That I think what's going to happen is more city planners, as more people move to cities, more city planners are going to plan on having facilities underground. And this will alleviate a lot of problems, including higher surface temperatures, but also lower energy costs. Because if you're living in a cave, it's that temperature the average all year round. So it's pleasant in the summer and it's pleasant in the winter. I could see that happening more and more, especially in American cities, where we are going to be looking to the underground for a little bit of salvation from what happens in the future.
We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, we'll have more with Anthony Martin about the world beneath our feet. This is Two Way Street. Back to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anthony Martin. He's the author of The Evolution Underground, Burrows, Bunkers, and the Marvelous Subterranean World Beneath Our Feet. We're talking about the multitude of species of animals that live their lives underground, and in doing so, provide important benefits to humans. So let's talk about worms and ants. You have a quote at the start of one of your chapters. When we behold a wide turf-covered expanse, we should remember that its smoothness, on which so much of its beauty depends, is mainly due to all the inequities having been slowly leveled by worms. Whose quote is that?
That is Charles Darwin. And Charles Darwin, people who study Charles Darwin know this about him, but I find lots of people who may just know about him for his contributing to evolutionary theory didn't know he loved worms. He absolutely adored earthworms. And his very last book was about earthworms and how earthworms level the earth or change the surface of the earth that we live on. Wherever you look at a continent, there are worms underneath that surface that are burrowing and changing the chemistry of the soil and making those soils better.
And you had at least in this book, had described encounters with earthworms, again, in Georgia at Wormslow in South Georgia, which is exactly where?
That's a little bit south of Savannah.
Yeah.
So there's Wormslow Historic Site, it's called. It's an old plantation site that's now undergoing an intensive ecological restoration led by the University of Georgia. So it's very neat to watch that happening. I was there a few years ago and with Craig Barrow, who he and his wife, they still live there on the grounds. He's an avid hunter, and times he had hosted my wife Ruth and I before, we'd often gone out and looked at the woods there, and he really enjoyed tracking. So we had great exchanges about animal tracks and animal behavior based on the tracks. Well, one morning when we were his guest, I went out tracking with him, and we noticed on the road all of these little trails. And at first I thought they were maybe from beetles. And I was like, wow, the beetles must have been really busy last night. But they weren't. I was wrong. And in science, we like to admit when we're wrong. These were worms. All of these trails had worms at their ends. What we figured out was that there had been a high tide the night before, and the salt marsh was nearby. I think what had happened was the high tide rose in the water table. The worms said, we're on strict low-salt diets, no thank you, and popped up to the surface and risked predation by robins or whatever other birds might have been out there, and then made all these trails. So that was an eye-opening experience for me because I'd never seen so many earthworms by the Georgia coast before, and this realization that their behavior is often connected to the tides and that there are so many of them there.
Okay, so let me ask, is that a parallel situation to after a heavy rain, even in an urban environment, suddenly see many worms on the sidewalks? Is that the same kind of thing?
Yeah, similar sort of thing and I was just noticing this last week and previous weeks where we've had a few heavy rains here in the Atlanta area. As I do a daily walk through a local park in Decatur, I always look at the ground because I'm thinking about what's beneath my feet. And I see all of the earthworm castings from where they have come up after a hard rain. What happens is the water fills the pores in the soil, and it displaces the oxygen. So it's not so much the worms would drown, it's that they would asphyxiate if they're below the surface and they stay below the surface. So as soon as the water starts occupying the pores of the soil, then they pop up to the surface. And again, that's how they risk predation. Normally, they're safe from those robins and other birds that might nab them, but they will risk their lives to come up to the surface if there's a heavy rain that affects them that way.
I want to get a better understanding of why Darwin found worms so fascinating.
I think Darwin, as a geologist and a biologist, and this is something I always like to point out about Darwin, he was a very good, well-trained geologist. He started thinking about gradual processes. And what evidently happened was, I think it was in the 1830s, when he was still a relatively young man, his uncle was remarking about how some cinder or chalk that he had put down in a garden had been completely displaced. And Darwin put one and one together, realized this was from worms. But he realized that the worms took a very long time to do this. So what he did in typical Darwin fashion was he did a long-term experiment. He put these stones out in his backyard in Downhouse, just south of London. Put these stones out in the yard. He had his son Horace make a device to measure how quickly were the stones getting buried. And we're talking fractions of a millimeter a year. But by golly, he measured it and showed that, extrapolated the results and showed that these worms are turning over a lot of soil, tons of soil.
What are the larger implications of that in our lives day to day? What implications does it have for our environment?
The implications are that our environments are largely controlled by what plants we have on the surface that we're eating or using for various resources. So that's everything from oats to trees, for instance. The soil quality is being affected and controlled by what other animals are living below the plants and enriching the soils, mixing the soils, aerating the soils, making the soils more conducive for that plant growth. If we didn't have earthworms, if we didn't have ants and a lot of these other animals that are mixing the soil and bringing those seeds up and otherwise changing those environments, the world would be a lot less diverse place and a lot less pleasant for us.
Darwin, you tell us, realized after his experiments that earthworms could alter the surface of the earth.
That's right. And there was a recent study done by some biologists down in South America. I think it was in Venezuela, where they demonstrated that again. There were these landforms there that had always been a mystery. What caused these bumpy landscapes there that would continue for miles and miles through the countryside? Well, the scientists found out the answer was earthworms, that there were these giant earthworms that live in that area that were actually concentrating their soil castings in these areas that then became mounds, and it was taking soil from the surrounding areas. So that you see this, when you look at the photos, the aerial photos, this dimpled landscape looking like the surface of a basketball just going off into the distance, wow, all from worms.
So I want to talk about another species in your book, and to introduce it, I want to play you this.
We're just about to get our first pictures from inside the spacecraft with average not Homer Simpson. And we'd like to... Ladies and gentlemen, we've just lost the picture, but what we've seen speaks for itself. The Corvair spacecraft has apparently been taken over, conquered, if you will, by a master race of giant space ants. It's difficult to tell from this vantage point whether they will consume the captive Earthman or merely enslave them. One thing is for certain, there is no stopping them. The ants will soon be here. And I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords. I'd like to remind them that as a trusted TV personality, I can be helpful in rounding up others to toil in their underground sugar caves.
What is that, Tony?
That's from Deep Space Homer, is the episode with The Simpsons. I'm a huge Simpsons fan, yeah, so I knew I had to put a Simpsons reference somewhere in the book. And that was the appropriate one, in that I titled that section of the chapter, Hail Ants.
And you say ants really are our overlords.
They really are. And this is something ecologist E.O. Wilson has also brought across, is that ants make up approximately 10% of all animal biomass. They are consisting of anywhere from 12 to 15,000 species. They can form the largest social organized colonies of any animals known. They've been around for more than 100 million years. I've seen trace fossils of ant nests from the Cretaceous all the way up through, of course, their domination of terrestrial environments today. They really are the overlords. We should hail them.
You tell us that the biomass of ants is equal to the biomass of all human beings on the face of the earth because there are probably more than a million ants per individual human.
That sounds about right, yeah. And that's a mind-boggling figure. And for people who are creeped out by ants, I don't cite it to them very often. But we need to remind ourselves that this underworld that is dominated by ants, most of these ant species have nests underground, that this is a very large part of the world we share with them.
What are super colonies?
Super colonies are from these ant species that can be in very widely separated areas. And the example I talk about in the book is this Argentine ant that's become an invasive species many different places of the world. And an example I give in there of the super colony is how similar they are in terms of their pheromones and how they connect with one another. You could take part of a colony, say, from Spain, move it to Japan, or move it to California, and they could all talk with one another. And that is, again, a mind-boggling idea associated with ants, that we keep finding out new facts about ants that keep surprising us. And I like to think that it's because of this, they're having evolved underground over the past 100 million years.
Am I correct for instance, in Europe, there are colonies that stretch for many, many, many miles. Do you describe that to us?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So I cite some of the research that's been done on that just recently in the last 5 or 6 years from what I'm remembering, where that astonished the researchers too. They didn't expect the colonies to be that extensive. Entire coastlines that have these ant colonies all along them and all somehow connected to one another.
You make the point that ants burrow in an entirely different way. And I think any of us who had little ant farms
That's right.
have seen this in action. They dig these extraordinary underground colonies in an entirely different way. Yes?
Yes, that's right. What they do is they pick up each individual sand grain or pebble or piece of vegetation or whatever it might be, they pick it up with their mouths and move it one grain at a time. And this is where their collective action, they're called eusocial insects because they have this caste system in which they have division of labor. They're able to do this because they have millions of ants in a colony. So you multiply those millions of particles by millions of ants, next thing you know, you have this massive nest. Well, they don't do that really by digging. So it's just removal of particles one at a time is how they do it. To me, again, that's astonishing and just reminds me of a time when I was a kid out in my wild kingdom on my backyard in Indiana, watching ants do this, just pull up particle after particle out of the ground and then deposit it. And they keep doing it and they keep changing those environments through that.
You cite a short story in the book that I probably read when I was a teenager, and it was one of the scariest stories I recall reading. What story is it, and what does it tell you about
yes,
ants?
That's Lenigan versus the Ants. Yeah. Yes, it's a childhood classic, I think, for multiple generations. It's about a plantation owner, I think in South America, somewhere in South America, where he and his workers decide they're going to make a stand against some army ants. So there's an invading horde of army ants, millions of army ants going across the landscape and destroying everything in their path. And they're relentless. Nothing stops them. And this plantation owner is so stubborn in thinking that he, the clever human, can outwit the ants. And not to spoil the end of the story for anybody, but the ants almost beat him.
Yeah. Yeah. He can't outsmart them.
He
ants.
Can't outsmart them.
I was coated from head to foot with the fiends. Tongues of fire stabbed at me as they bit into my flesh. I almost lost my head with the pain as I ran knocking ants from my body, brushing them from my bloody face. And then one bit me just below the rim of my goggles. I managed to tear him away. But the agony of the bite and its venom drilled into the eye nerves. I saw now through circles of fire into a milky mist. I was almost blinded, but I knew that if I tripped and fell, I ran on, my heart pounding as if it would burst, blood roaring in my ears, a giant's fist battering my lungs.
Why do ants matter to us?
Ants matter to us because they are mixing soils, so they are performing the same sort of important role that earthworms fulfill. They bring up seeds as a result, so they end up bringing up seeds and other types of plant material that then enrich plant communities. They're food for a lot of animals. There are ant eaters. And in Montana one time, I was very surprised to see a scat in diggings from a grizzly bear, where a grizzly bear actually dug up an ant nest. Sure enough, when I looked it up later, grizzly bears will eat ants. So I called it High Plains Anteater in that respect. So thinking about that, yeah, that this huge, ferocious carnivore also uses ants as a food resource. That made me rethink about ants and their importance as being menu items for a lot of animals out there.
Anthony Martin will be back after a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about his other job as a paleontologist. In that role, he did something really big. He was co-discoverer of a previously unknown specimen of dinosaur.
Beep, beep, beep.
Our guest on Two-Way Street today is Emory University Professor Anthony Martin. We've been talking about his new book, The Evolution Underground, a look at the thousands of species of animals that live beneath our feet. But now we're going to talk about a different aspect of his work. Martin's a paleontologist, and in 2006, working with several colleagues at a dig in southwestern Montana, he and his fellow paleontologists made a remarkable discovery: the skeletal remains of a 95-million-year-old dinosaur, a dinosaur that had never been seen by scientists before. You tell us that you've been fascinated by dinosaurs since you were a kid, like a lot of people are. And you also tell us the mass extinctions were survived. The dinosaurs couldn't survive them. The creatures that survived were the burrowers and the birds who could fly to escape them. You put those two together and discovered with a number of your colleagues, you were the first to discover a burrowing dinosaur.
Yeah, that's correct. We were very, very lucky, because this was a dinosaur, a relatively small dinosaur, only about a little over 6 feet long, called Erictodromius cubicularis. And the reason that comes off of my tongue so quickly is because I got to help name it. So I practiced that name.
Where did that name come from?
The name comes from, Erictodromius refers to digger. So it comes from the Greek to dig. And then the dromius part is runner. So we wanted to represent that this was a two-legged dinosaur, a small herbivorous dinosaur, two-legged, but it also had these powerful digging arms in the front, and it had a snout adapted for digging as well. Then the cubicularis part of its name refers to of the den, that this was in a den. This dinosaur, we were lucky enough to find in its burrow with two of its partially grown juveniles. So there were three dinosaurs in this burrow, and I helped describe the burrow. My colleague Yoshi Katsura discovered the bones. And then Dave Riccio, my good friend, also from University of Georgia days, when we were graduate students there together.
You found these was in southwest Montana.
And we found these in southwest Montana.
Okay.
And the burrow was there. The bones were in the burrow. So Dave brought me out there to Montana for a few days, where we dug up the burrow and then looked at it, because it was this natural cast formed of sandstone where you could actually look at it like a bas relief sculpture in three dimensions. So we described it thoroughly, and then when we published on it a couple of years later, it was documented as the first known burrowing dinosaur associated with its burrow, and that it used this burrow for raising its young.
What was that like, that discovery for you?
Pretty darn thrilling. And it's something I still pinch myself that this happened, because a lot of kids grow up thinking, yeah, I want to be a paleontologist. I want to study dinosaurs. And I've studied a lot of other things other than dinosaurs. But to be able to name a dinosaur, to be part of that discovery, and one that had this, as far as we know, so far unique behavior, all of that was thrilling.
So maybe this is an unanswerable question, but if this species of dinosaur was able to burrow to protect itself from the environment or from meteorites, did it survive and take another form later, or did it get wiped out too?
Yeah, it's a great question with thinking about the evolution and extinction of dinosaurs, in that this species of dinosaur lived about 95 million years ago. And we don't know of any burrowing dinosaurs between it and 65 million years ago. About 65, 66 million years ago, that's when a meteorite impacted the Earth, and we have really good geological evidence backing that up. That also, we don't think is a coincidence, is when the non-bird dinosaurs all went extinct. Now, here's a cool thing that almost every five-year-old will tell you, is that birds are dinosaurs. So evolutionarily, when we're looking at birds today that come to your bird feeder, those are living descendants of dinosaurs. They are living with us today. So I talk about this in the book then, about not just the burrowing dinosaur, but all of these dinosaurs living today that burrow underground. And I speculate a little bit about maybe the birds that did survive that mass extinction, maybe their nests were underground.
They didn't evolve before the extinction event. They may have been burrowing, and it survived and then ended up evolving as flying creatures.
Yeah, well, they were already flying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they were already flying, and there was a study that I was part of in Australia where I helped discover the oldest evidence of birds in Australia from tracks. And one of the tracks, you could see the scratch mark from its rear claw as it came in for a landing. So that was a flighted bird, and that was more than 100 million years ago. Birds were flighted for well before the extinction, but what I speculate is that some birds may have had their burrows underground as a way of survival for their eggs.
So as we finish, what's the next adventure for you?
That's a good question. Next adventure, well, I've been doing this long-term project on the Georgia coast. One of my previous books was titled Life Traces of the Georgia Coast, and I have this love for the coast and the traces there. But I've been doing this project that we think is going to be a long-term project at Emory with the Center for Digital Scholarship, where we're trying to put together a digital atlas, and an atlas about the natural and human history of the islands. Again, looking at this treasure we have in our backyard here in Georgia, with the Georgia coast and these islands that many of them have not been developed, documenting this natural and human history and then making it publicly available. This is, I think, my next big project. Don't ask me what book I'm going to write next. I don't know yet. I'm still enjoying this one.
I think you should. And that book is The Evolution Underground, Burrows, Bunkers, and the Marvelous Subterranean World Beneath Our Feet, written by our guest, Anthony J. Martin. You know, it was fun to talk to you about all of this today. When I first picked up the book, I thought, well, this is a little daunting, I think. But the stories are really interesting, fascinating, and give me a glimpse at worlds I just never knew anything about. So thanks for coming in and talking about it with me today.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
We've posted more information about Anthony Martin's book on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. If you're interested in his dinosaur research, you'll also find a link to a Scientific American article on his previous book, Dinosaurs Without Bones. Before we leave you today, I want to tell you about a special Two-Way Street we'll be recording next Friday evening, March 17th, in front of a live audience at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library. We're going to be talking about something that seems to be one of the most common topics of concern and conversation in our lives: how we sleep. Are we stressed out because we don't think we're getting enough every night? Who said the best sleep is straight through for up to 8 hours at night? When did we decide children shouldn't sleep with their parents? Our guest, Benjamin Reese, has written a new book arguing that perhaps the standard rules of sleep are making us frustrated and actually leading us to sleep less. He suggests we might do better if we break some of the rules that we've always followed.
A lot of our trouble with sleep has to do with our society and our expectations. As soon as you have a rule, you have a conflict. Just tell a kid to go to bed at a certain time, you have a conflict. And the way our society organizes and structures sleep creates a lot of these conflicts, both within families and between different groups of people.
We'll talk to Reese about his book, Wild Nights: How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. And we'd love to have you in the audience for the conversation. We'll start at 7 p.m. at the Carter Library. It's free of charge, and you don't need a reservation. If you want more information, you'll find it on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page, too. Join us. I think it's going to be fun. That's it for this week. Remember, you can listen to Two Way Street on your own schedule by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And all of our shows are archived on our website. And if you want to share thoughts about the show, follow me on Twitter at NigutB. That's N-I-G-U-T-B. Our senior producer is the rarely reticent Jenny Ament. Our producer is the fabulously funny Lisa Clark. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for listening, and I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.